from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Scott Feibusch, in today for Evan Dawson. And our connection this hour is a pretty tenuous one. It's a 500 million kilometer link to a probe that is barely hanging on to the surface of a speeding comet. If you have any space geek in you at all, you probably spent a big chunk of your day yesterday waiting for news from Philae. That's the lander that dropped from the Rosetta spacecraft after a 10-year slingshot ride through the solar system. Nick Warner is a geologist at SUNY Geneseo. He's worked with NASA and the Jet Propulsion Lab on several missions to Mars. He joined me a little earlier this morning to help get us up to speed on where the mission stands right now.
It's an extremely rare event, obviously, to get any country or any group of countries to construct something of this magnitude. You know, a mission that requires 10 years of planning and operations to just send an object not only beyond Earth's orbit, but beyond Mars' orbit, out beyond the asteroid belt, about the equivalent distance of five times our distance from the sun. And then to hit it as this pinpoint small object, and to actually get into orbit of that object being the comet, and then adding on top of that, attaching a lander to the comet and having the lander successfully descend to the surface and land, it's absolutely amazing feat of engineering. And that's even before any of the science actually happens, is just getting there. And so we've done this for, you know, getting to Mars. We've done this for getting to Venus and Mercury. Japan even went to an asteroid before. But this is the first time that humans have ever orbited and landed on a comet. It's just tremendous.
We're talking about something that's the size of maybe Manhattan?
Yeah, it's about the size of a big city, basically, this comet. So it doesn't have a lot of gravity, which also complicates the engineering factor. You have to be able to get into orbit around something with extremely low gravity, and then to land on that object and to hold on to that object once you land is obviously, as we can see, a major challenge on something that's only the size of a city. So that's an engineering feat that has only really been handled a couple times before, and this is the first time on a comet.
What do we know now as of Thursday morning? I guess there was some doubt about whether or not the lander had actually completely kind of glommed onto the surface, right?
Yeah, based on the reports I saw this morning, they had their news conference. They now think that the lander descended successfully to the landing site that they had chosen originally, that they had mapped out, and that the harpoons didn't fire, although it apparently sent a signal that said it fired at first. And because of the low gravity, it hit with a velocity that caused it to bounce back up off the ground. And without that tether to hold it down, it couldn't stay put. So some of the reports I've seen have suggested that it bounced it several hundred meters back into space. One person even reported a kilometer, but I don't know if that held. But it bounced. It took about 2 hours for it to come back down again and make a second landing. And apparently, as of last night, they said there was two landings, but apparently as of this morning, they now think there were three landings. There was another bounce where it secured itself up against possibly a rim of a crater or some sort of cliff. And the latest report is also that it may only be on two legs. It had three legs. It's only on two. And it's tilted.
And we're hamstrung, I guess, a little bit too by some sort of sketchy communication. It's been difficult sometimes to keep contact between the mothership Rosetta and Philae, the probe that's actually on the surface, right?
Exactly, because as the comet and the orbiter are, you know, rotating around each other, essentially, the orbiter is rotating around the comet, the lander will be on the other side of the horizon, so you have communication issues. And now there's an issue also if the lander is up against an obstacle, a cliff, that could not only block some of the communication from the orbiter, but the big concern now is blocking sunlight. It's a solar-powered lander, and it needs to accumulate enough sun to do its science operation. So if part of the horizon is now obscured by the lander, by this cliff, and you can see it in the image, it's right up against something, that could be a serious problem for them. But my understanding is they did get at least 90 minutes, I believe, of solar power last night, where they expected a few hours. they were hoping for a few hours. So that's the latest major concern.
Assuming, for the sake of argument, let's be hopeful about it, that it's now safely secured to the surface and we can communicate with it and it's ready to go about doing its job. What now is that job? What's it going to do now that it's attached to the surface, and how long is it going to do it for?
Sure. It's got a whole suite of instruments on it. So one instrument is to actually drill down a few centimeters. I believe it was upwards of 20 centimeters, basically, to get down and scoop up some samples and to analyze the chemistry of those samples. So you can look at not only the major elements, like looking for carbon and oxygen and hydrogen, things that make up organic compounds, but they can also do isotopic measurements, looking at, you know, at a really fine scale, what types of oxygen are actually on the comet, which helps to understand the types of organic materials and the evolution of the comet. There's also, just from the camera perspective, just looking at the surface geology, and as a geologist, I'm interested in what does the landscape look like? What is it made of? Is it made of large boulders or small pebbles or ice that cements the large pebbles and boulders? And so that's really exciting from a geology standpoint as well. And they will also be able to look at the surface chemistry simply from reflection and some of the thermal properties of the surface as well, sort of a remote sensing of the landscape. And I think finally one of the big things they're going to monitor, and this is in particular for the lander, but also with Rosetta still doing its science operations, is they're going to be monitoring the change on the surface as it approaches the sun. Because comets obviously orbit around the sun like we do, and with all of the ice on the comet, the organic materials, the sun will cause that ice to vaporize, essentially, and you should see significant changes on the comet surface, and that's something that they'll monitor throughout the mission.
We are talking with Nick Warner from SUNY Geneseo, geologist, and someone who has been involved before in some of these missions. Now, you've worked with the Jet Propulsion Laboratory on some Mars missions. What is it like trying to figure out how to do science when you are millions and millions of miles away from the spot where otherwise you would just be sitting there digging into the rocks yourself?
Yeah, it would be much easier to be on, you know, out in the field, to be able to walk up to the outcrop of rock that you want to see and target and go through it systematically. So you have to rely, obviously, on machines, on robots and rovers. And a lot of my work up to this point has largely relied on the orbiting spacecraft, especially over Mars, that are taking these amazing images where you can, from space, where you can see something like, if you had a car on the surface of Mars, you could see it from space. That's how good of quality they are. So it's a little frustrating because you can't get down there and touch it, but you really train yourself to be able to understand geology and surface processes from a distance. Can interpret a landscape and what that landscape is telling you about what has happened in the past. And my particular interest in that is looking on Mars as to whether there was water or not. So I look at river channels and lakes and things like that. And we always are comparing what we see on other planets to what we can actually see in the field here on Earth. So the Earth is always the base for our understanding.
Let's talk a little bit about what that understanding gets us, because, you know, we've known obviously for a long time through flyby missions and, you know, through analysis, you know, we've known basically that a comet is, it's described as what, basically a rocky snowball?
Yep. Yeah, exactly.
Is the description. Yep. You know, there's the argument to be made, I suppose, that if I wait another month or so, I can go out to my driveway and find all the rocky snowballs I want and study them in depth. What are we hoping to learn? What does it contribute to our understanding here on Earth of being able to find all this out about something that's, you know, what, 500 million kilometers away at the moment?
Right. Well, the neat thing about these rocky snowballs is that they may be the origin of all of our water and ice and snow that we have on our planet. The idea is that when Earth and the other inner planets formed, that water and other ices could not actually form here in this part of the solar system. It was too hot, too close to the sun. And one of the ideas is that these comets, in the outer solar system, so now several million, hundreds of millions of miles, billions of miles out beyond the sun, that that's the only location where this ice could actually have formed early on, and that the comets were the mechanism early 4 billion years ago by which that water was delivered to our planet. And so all of the rivers and lakes and oceans that we see on Earth and some that we see on Mars may have had a lot of that delivered by these cometary objects. So we want to go to the comets to sort of look at what that primordial water was like. But that's just the water story. The other part of the story is that the comets also, based on our telescopic observations up to this point, we've found evidence that they have organic materials. So carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, there's nitrogen, all sorts of compounds that are required to form life, organic life. So when you combine the water story with the life story, the comets suddenly become really, really fascinating, and maybe are the ideas that they seeded the different planets with the components that you need to form life. And so we really need to characterize these comets to get an understanding if that's even true or possible.
That's pretty remarkable.
Yeah.
Now, the time frame here, the lander, as I understand it, could last maybe into the spring, perhaps, if we're lucky?
Yeah, if we're lucky, and the issue, like I said before, is with the solar power, and that's always the big issue with any of these types of missions, is you'd have to have enough energy to keep it going. They design it to last for a few months, and as we've seen with some of the NASA missions, the rover missions, they will last longer than that if you can keep the power, if you can keep it going, because they're constructed really well. But in this case, it is a little worrying that it is up against this cliff. So we'll have to monitor over the next few days, just looking at the reports coming out of ESA, whether or not it's getting enough power every night to stay alive. And a large part of that is making sure that the instruments, after a cold night without having any sunlight, whether the instruments can have enough power to turn on again the next day. That's the real issue. And so if the instruments start dying or failing, then the mission could end abruptly. Fortunately, at least it landed safely. That's the important thing, and they are getting data now. So we will have data. It's not a failure. The mission is not a failure by any means. It's actually a big success.
Yeah, by all accounts, definitely a huge one.
Yeah.
Should we, from the standpoint of the U.S., what attitude should we take in looking at this being a European project? Should we be celebrating the fact that there's development now in space happening around the world, or is there a sense that we might want to look at this and say, maybe we need to up our game again on some of these projects?
Yeah, I think it's actually really, really promising that you have other countries and groups of countries, in this case, getting together to work on these missions. There is NASA contribution on this mission, but it is largely an ESA run with components from the UK, from Germany and France. And they've put together their collective resources to make this amazing mission. I believe it's actually over €1 billion in cost. And when you put all those resources together, you can do something like this. So NASA has actually started to adopt this idea of involving several different countries in actually providing instrumentation for the rovers and landers that we've been sending. So there's several missions upcoming, the Mars 2020 mission, the InSight mission to Mars, that have European instruments on board. So I think as we go forward in the future, that's the way space travel is going to have to be. It's going to have to, it's expensive enough that it requires the budget and the human power of multiple countries to go forward.
I want to touch on that question of human power, because obviously I'm sure as a geologist who studied Mars, you would love nothing more than to be on the surface there, looking at it firsthand and being able to wander around and dig up whatever looks interesting.
Yeah.
Have we advanced far enough in terms of being able to send probes and landers to the point where worrying about maybe doing a manned mission to Mars eventually is almost superfluous now?
Yeah, Mars is still at the lead of the next step in human exploration, although NASA has discussed the possibility of doing an asteroid mission in between that as a proof of concept that we can, again, get outside of our own Earth gravitational attraction and go out to an object that's beyond even the moon and walk around on that object, sort of to prove the technology, to prove that we can do it with an object that's a little bit closer than Mars. But Mars is still, as of right now, NASA's primary objective for human exploration because of the obvious evidence on the surface that Mars was once more Earth-like, with river channels and lakes and streams and things like that. So it's still the target. It's a ways off still. There's several missions that have to happen in the interim, and we still need NASA still needs a spacecraft that can get us out of Earth's orbit, and that's being worked on now. That's the Orion spacecraft. And they're doing a test in December, actually, an unmanned spaceflight test to start that whole process going. So you should expect to see in the news over the next several months and the next few years an emphasis on this human exploration using that spacecraft.
And in terms of studying comets, what's the next step there once we get beyond this mission?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's going to have to be, you know, another if we find something with this mission that's really enticing in terms of the organic materials and the water ice and things that we find, then that would be the instigator to do another one. You know, it's a really long process, 10 years, a billion euros plus in their case. And you really need that drive, both scientific drive, but also the public drive to get behind something like that. So if they find something really exciting, I think you may see more interest in going back by other countries, like the United States, for example. But in the interim, a lot of the research is being done, telescopic research and modeling, trying to understand in the laboratory how ice behaves at really low temperature in a vacuum, how organic material behaves. So that research is always ongoing all across the world. It's just whether you have the reason to construct another mission of this scale, we'll have to see.
And, of course, the technology keeps improving. It's got to be frustrating that here you have this lander with 10-year-old technology.
Yeah.
I'm sure if you were launching it today, it would be able to do even more than it can do now, right?
Yeah, that's the thing people don't realize about these missions. With the Curiosity rover to Mars, for example, you know, it landed just a couple of years ago, but it was being built several years ago. And the whole mission starts 10 years before the landing in many cases. And so the cameras, the instrumentation you see, all of that technology is 5-10 years old in many cases. And so you build on that each time and you start production each time. Now, there is the adage, though, that, and especially at NASA, if there is a technology that works and it's proven to work on Mars, they try to fly it again or use similar, they call it heritage design, to keep the cost of the mission down. And if you know it works, why go to a different design? But there are always components that are being revised and tested that are new.
When you have that long a commute to get to work, I guess you really have to be prepared, right?
Exactly.
Nick Warner from the Geology Department at SUNY Geneseo joining us with an update on the European mission to land on a comet. We'll take a quick break, and then we will turn our attention to another technology connection closer to home. Coming up in our second hour, if you're poor and trying to juggle kids and a job, how do you afford childcare? A new report sheds some light on whether state subsidies are enough. Plus, we'll get an update on WXXI's Affordable Care Act coverage. It's all coming up in our second hour, just ahead on Connections.
Stay up all night, go to dance clubs, yeah, that's a job.
When I was, you know, 16, 17, I would never, in my deepest dreams, think that I could make a living and make a good living as a DJ.
I'm Kai Rizdal, Major Lazer, Diplo, call him what you will, but he might just be the future of the music business. That story next time on Marketplace from APM.
This evening at 6:30.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Scott Feibusch in today for Evan Dawson. And our connection for this portion of the hour is the one between the providers who bring you content over the internet and you. We are talking about net neutrality and about the question of whether or not an internet service provider can control how fast and which content even reaches you at all. And we have some expert guests joining us as well as you. We hope you'll give us a call at 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. If you're tweeting us today, Tweet us at WXXI News, because Evan is not here. You can tweet Evan Dawson, but he's not here. So good luck with that. Our guests this half hour on Connections are Remy DeCausemaker, who is the resident hackademic at the RIT Magic Center and the free and open source software research coordinator. And joining us by phone is Julie Samuels, the executive director of Engine. It's a nonprofit focused on tech entrepreneurship. And Julie was formerly with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, where she was, among other things, the Mark Cuban chair to eliminate stupid patents. So let's begin with the question. I think for those of us who are pretty deep in the weeds on this, we've been hearing net neutrality for a long time. A lot of people are just kind of hearing about it this week, and some of them are hearing about it particularly because of the way it became a political issue. Just a few days ago, Senator Ted Cruz from Texas tweeted, and I quote, "Net neutrality is Obamacare for the Internet. The Internet should not operate at the speed of government." So we'll pick that apart in a minute, but first let me start with you, Remy. What is net neutrality? Why should people be thinking about this?
Sure. So first, thank you so much for having me on the program. It's great. Net neutrality, as defined by our very friendly community-driven encyclopedia, Wikipedia, is the principle that internet service providers and governments should treat all data and on the internet equally, not discriminating or charging differently by user, by content, site, platform, application, equipment, modes of communication, or any other reason. It was a term coined by Tim Wu, who is a Columbia media law professor in 2003.
And nearly our lieutenant governor, perhaps, if the if the elections had gone a different way. Julie, how did this suddenly become a political issue?
Well, the truth is net neutrality has always largely been a political issue. It's an incredibly partisan issue, which is actually somewhat rare for tech policy. Tech policy tends to be a bit more bipartisan. But the truth is, and I think, I hope, over the course of the segment, we'll get a little bit into the weeds about what's really going on here. But what the president did this week really kind of highlighted the political divide. And I think we hadn't heard so much from the politics before because a lot of people were surprised to see the president take such a strong stance.
Well, let's go back to that then. It was not, I think, on anybody's radar that this was going to be one of the issues that was going to pop up in the second half of his term. But all of a sudden, there he was taking this strong stand and saying that he's firmly in favor, essentially, of treating internet service providers as common carriers. And we should probably back up and explain, okay, what is a common carrier?
So you want me to, I can talk about that for a second.
The
legal question here is exactly that, is do you treat the internet as a common carrier? That means, and this is going to be a little in the legal weeds for a second, so bear with me. In order to do that, a common carrier is what we commonly think of as utilities. It's telephone lines, electricity, highways, roads, things that everyone has equal access to by law. Many, many years, there's been debate over whether the internet should fall into that category or not. And so far, the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, has tried to thread the needle without having to make that jump into common carriage. Because to do that, they have to do this thing, which is reclassify the internet under Title II of the Federal Communications Act. So confusing, really deep in the weeds, but the FCC has to kind of change the way it treats the internet to make that happen. A federal appellate court about 8 months ago essentially told the FCC that if you want real net neutrality, if you want equal access for everyone online, you're going to have to do this reclassification thing. So this fight's been going on in D.C. since, for the past 8 or 9 months. But it's really been kind of inside baseball. But with the president's really bold statement on Monday, that largely changed.
Who are the players in this? Obviously, you have political players on both sides of the issue in Washington. There's a lot of money flowing in. Who are the players who actually have something at stake in this game, besides, obviously, us as people who sit there and use the internet at home? Remy, you want to?
Sure. So ultimately, it's up to the FCC, right? And it's an independent agency that's responsible for making decisions about, all types of communication things. The most commented issue that they've dealt with in the past was the wardrobe malfunction, right, that drew something like 1 million comments. Net neutrality has driven over 4 million. So, you know, it's really on the plate of somebody like Chairman Wheeler to make the decision, regardless of, you know, how other folks are coming out in support.
But you've got some big business players in here too. What are the Julie, you want to talk to who some of the, you know, some of the people who are on the other side of this,
sure.
who they are and what they're saying?
Yeah, well, I actually think you make an important point when you talk about business players too, because there are, to be clear, a lot of business interests who support net neutrality and Title II. The startup community, by and large, supports Title II, pretty much across the board. A lot of it, most, actually all internet companies support real net neutrality, as far as I know. So there are a lot of companies. However, on the other side of things, you have the large cable companies, the large internet service providers, the Comcast, AT&Ts, and Verizons of the world. So while those companies are a minority of companies, I mean, a real minority of companies, they are incredibly well-funded. And, you know, we haven't seen the most recent numbers, but the last numbers we've seen was something like those cable companies and the telcos outspend the folks fighting for net neutrality on at least a 3-to-1 basis in lobbying dollars in D.C. So they're well-resourced. They're have hired, you know, armies of lobbyists, and they're all over Capitol Hill right now screaming and yelling that there's no way FCC should reclassify the internet as a common carrier.
What is the argument on the other side? I mean, we obviously, we're a little one-sided on the panel that we have here today in favor of net neutrality. There is an argument on the other side. The you know, in our case here in Rochester, it's Time Warner Cable and it's Frontier that provide the vast majority of internet connections to homes and businesses around here. In most places, those are your only two choices. We've got some fiber that's beginning to roll out in a few neighborhoods, not mine yet, which is killing me, but we've got some independent fiber providers who are starting to roll out. But, you know, certainly there's this argument that a Time Warner or that a Frontier would make to say, well, you know, we're investing all of this money in building these networks, in improving capacity on networks to stream video that we weren't streaming even 5 years ago, never mind 10 years ago. And, you know, on any given night, 60 or 70% of our traffic is coming from one place, which is Netflix. Why shouldn't they pay for some of that? What's the argument there?
Remy, you want to go ahead?
Sure,
go after? Yeah.
So it's the idea of double dipping, right? Consumers are already paying for access to the net, and really treating a different type of content as a different kind of traffic is problematic, right? Imagine the mail. Right. We're sending mail. We're sending packages. Those envelopes are all treated equally. They're all based on the weight, right? The speed that they come through. But can you imagine that depending on what the actual words are in your letter, it could cost more or less to be delivered to your house? Just because Netflix is sending the mail doesn't mean that Netflix should pay for a special kind of stamp to ship Netflix envelopes, right? And that kind of market discrimination is bad, because what's going to stop other companies, organizations, people from outside of the country from having to pay for their own kind of metered services in other markets? The internet isn't just one internet. It's a patchwork of small networks and servers all over the world. And we have all agreed to share each other's mail and help deliver it. And when we start artificially slowing things down based on who made what deals in a back room, that's going to clog up traffic for everyone, and all the mail will suffer.
Julie, you want to take a stab at it?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I think what you're talking about here, well, first of all, I completely agree with everything Remy just said. I think that those are some really great analogies to explain what's going on. But our internet in this country is incredibly slow and incredibly expensive compared to most of our European counterparts. I think that when you frame the argument like you did at the outset, there is in theory a compelling case, like, we built this, we should get to do what we want with it. But as a society, we've decided there are certain things that are so elemental to how we live, you know, water, electricity, roads, that we treat them differently. And this is one of those. I'm sure that everyone who's listening right now has an internet provider, and that internet provider costs a lot of money. and their internet is not always so fast or so working so great, but they're making, these internet providers are making tons of money. Like, what we're talking about here is really just a drop in the bucket. And I think it's disingenuous to pretend otherwise.
It is Connections here on member-supported public radio, WXXI, WRUR, and WEOS. Scott Feibusch in for Evan Dawson, and we are joined for this segment by Remy DeCausemaker from RIT and Julie Samuels, Executive Director of Engine. And I want to explore a little bit some of the issues of some of the connections that exist and some of the conflicts that exist, because, of course, one of the reasons that the cable companies in particular are looking so closely at this issue is that we've seen the sea change in the last, what, 4 or 5 years, where people are cutting the cord on getting linear video delivered to them over cable, and they're saying, I just want to use my internet pipeline, get whatever video I want, whether I get it from Netflix or from Hulu or by watching YouTube or wherever I get it from. And in some cases, this is a very big threat to existing business models, particularly for cable, is it not?
That's exactly right. And I think you highlight another really interesting point, too, and what one of the things we're worried about with regards to net neutrality. Let's say Comcast is your cable provider. This is what I'm about to explain is actually a fairly common occurrence. Comcast is your cable provider and your internet provider. You're at home. You're trying to watch Netflix. It's buffering. It's slow. It's annoying. So you're like, screw this. I'm just going to use cable. I'm going to use on-demand because I know that I'm going to get a clearer picture. So in that instance, what you see is that Comcast is able to favor its own content, because so many of these internet companies are also content companies, is able to favor its own content against competitors. And, you know, listen, Netflix is a really big company, and I'm glad for them that they're doing well, but I'm not really worried about the Netflixes of the world. I'm worried about the small startups, the individual speakers, who, because of so much congestion on the network, they're going to get their content kind of pushed to the back, because if we don't get real net neutrality, what we're essentially saying to Comcast and AT&T and Verizon and Time Warner is, you can pick whoever you want to go first. You guys are in charge of making that decision.
Yeah, and there's other video startups that are trying to do more, even in our state in New York. Downstate New York, Vimeo is another video provider that does curated content around a number of content creators. And they've been a scrappy startup for a long time, and they've been, you know, quite successful in drawing new users, and it's a new business in New York in our economy. And they can't afford to have to pay for the same types of fast lanes that someone like a Netflix can. So really, it's absolutely going to impact somebody like Vimeo or any other content creation company that's a new scrappy startup, which most of these companies started out as, right? Like, even some of our favorite websites like Facebook started out in a dorm room, right? Can you imagine if Zuck had to pay for Fastlane access for Facebook? I mean, would it have grown the same way, especially if MySpace was already in the market and able to pay for that? I mean, that type of discrimination against small businesses and upcoming innovation is a threat to the market. It's a threat to innovation, and we'll see it stagnate, and we won't see the same types of companies and very cool inventions come down the pipe that we could.
There's another interesting business piece to this, too, especially for us here in Rochester, where we're served by what's now Time Warner Cable, is that they're still trying to get regulatory approval, in part from the same FCC that's considering net neutrality, in order to get bought out by Comcast. And right. You know, they would very much like to get to the point where a year from now, we're Comcast here and not Time Warner Cable. Is the net neutrality fight, do you see that having any impact on whether or not the Time Warner Comcast deal happens?
Yeah, I think that there's some conventional wisdom, actually, that if we get the right, what I think is the right or the best result on net neutrality, which is what President Obama called for on Monday, that it actually might be a little bit more likely that merger goes through. And it depends. I mean, so in the past, some of the bigger mergers have gone through because the parties have agreed to limit themselves to certain behaviors. So, for instance, Comcast is already under an obligation for the next couple of years to follow net neutrality rules, even though no other cable company is, and that was the result of an earlier merger. So we might see that again, but if there are really strong rules, that kind of negotiating chip might be off the table. But these things are moving quickly. It's hard to kind of keep on top of all the moving parts this week, especially. It's nuts.
Certainly the case. We want to bring you into the conversation. You can call us at 844-295-TALK, 844-295-TALK. 295-8255. You can tweet us at WXXI News. Use that handle today instead of Evan's usual handle. He'll be back next week with more shows. You can tweet him directly then if you'd like. Again, we are here with Julie Samuels from Engine and Remy DeCausemaker, the resident hackademic at RIT's Magic Center. Julie, you had mentioned earlier, and I want to really kind of put this into context, that we don't realize sometimes here in the U.S. for what we're paying for internet service, that what we're getting has fallen pretty behind what the rest of the world gets. You'd mentioned Europe. I know Korea especially. Let's talk a little bit about what's available, what consumers in Asia are getting access to through their internet pipelines that we're not getting here. Is it costing providers there that much more to provide much higher speed services to them?
I think I'm not sure what it actually costs providers in a lot of those countries, but you're exactly right. In some of the Asian countries in particular, everyone gets fiber. We have a small handful of municipalities in the United States who have access to, widespread access to fiber. And those people are getting significantly faster internet than the rest of America. But that is how it is in a lot of countries. And in a lot of countries, that's even subsidized by the government. So people pay, the equivalent of $30 a month for faster internet than we have access to even in our offices. And it's really unfortunate, and I think that people tend to lose sight of that. And we've got to kind of fix our policies to ensure that there's real competition in the marketplace. Here's the thing about net neutrality, and I think this is really interesting, especially as we're talking about some of the politics behind it. Traditionally, conservatives have kind of opposed net neutrality. But that's kind of funny to me, because what we're actually talking about is having real competition in the marketplace. So it actually seems like something conservatives would be in favor of. You're talking about competition for speakers to get online, real competition for, so that, as the president said, the next Facebook or the next Google can compete against the current Facebook and the current Google. And also, this is also competition in internet providers. I live in Manhattan, and I can only get Time Warner in my building. That's it, period, full stop. I used to live in San Francisco, and I had many more options, actually. And I ended up getting to go with a local company who used some different mesh networking technology. But when there's no competition, what incentive does Time Warner have to get me better internet? Not very much.
Indeed. Again, 844-295-TALK is our phone number, at WXXI News on Twitter. Jake asks, what would this mean for wireless internet like Verizon, where it is critical for their networks to manage traffic based on type? Is there still a difference at this point between the more restricted amount of bandwidth you can get on say, a 4G service even, compared to what you might be able to get by fiber or cable at home? Is there a reason for rules to be different for those carriers?
That's actually a really good question. So in 2010, the last time the FCC put out some rules on this issue, they carved out wireless, they carved out mobile, and they kind of said, listen, this market's still too new. We're not going to impose any rules yet. We're going to let the market figure it out. But this time it's looking like the FCC, in whatever rules it ends up issuing, is going to probably include mobile. So there will be some similar net neutrality type regulations around mobile. The details are hazy. But there's another really important point in that question, and it's that a lot of these rules actually give the ISPs or the mobile carriers or whatever the ability to do reasonable network management, kind of no matter what.
Okay, Jake, thanks for that question here on Connections. We go to the phones. Hale in Sparta, you're on Connections. What's your question?
Thank you. First, I wanted to say I support net neutrality and the president's call to treat it like rural electrification in the 30s rather than, some fee-for-hire thing. I just wonder how either poorer folks, and there's a lot of injustice depending on how you look at things these days, as well as rural folks like myself would have access to the internet or to wireless as the market forces influencing this, like Time Warner wouldn't serve us. To go out 4,000 more feet, they wanted something like $6,000 to run the wire. So we were happy to get through the local corporation, Frontier, communications, DSL, and with that, we're near the end of the line. So we have 0.5 meg, whereas I was just speaking to a customer service person at Frontier, and they say nationally their average is 6 meg. So wouldn't it be great if there was some movement like there was for rural electrification, or to have a much higher rate of internet access in addition to net neutrality, because it's really not working very well for folks who have a half a meg versus the average for Frontier Corporation, I was told a few minutes ago, as 6 meg. So how would that happen? That's the question. I'll take the answer off the line.
All right, thanks for the call, Hal.
Yeah, absolutely. Rural access to information is really important, and it's the number one way that people in rural areas are starting to access, not just here in the U.S., but internationally in places like Africa, is through the mobile broadband network, right? People aren't starting out by getting PCs. They're starting out by getting broadband connections and then connecting through those types of devices, which is why it is imperative that these devices also fall under the same types of neutrality regulations that the other types of, you know, regular internet does too. I think that it's important that, you know, by not giving an incumbent an advantage to ISPs and people and companies who can afford to pay for the fast lanes, we will see more startups come up that can provide that sort of last mile, if you will, support to hook people up to the net, because they're not going to have to worry about, you know, dealing with second class internet bit citizenship, right? They're startups that do the sort of mesh networking stuff, I think, is really the key. You know, the more competition that we see in the market, the more honest it'll keep some of the dominant ISPs and providers that are around. And hopefully that type of competition will drive down prices to the point where we'll see more people enter the market as well.
It's interesting, we've seen some of the bigger opponents to net neutrality already sort of holding out little, I don't know if you want to call them threats or not, but I think it was Verizon this week that said, okay, or AT&T rather, was saying, we're going to hold up, they're going to do a fiber rollout to something like 100 more markets and get high-speed fiber to more people. And now they said very publicly this week, well, you know, if net neutrality happens, we may not be able to afford to keep this build out. In fact, we're going to just kind of halt it right now until we know what's going to happen. Is that a valid threat? Is it a threat in particular if you're somebody like Hale living in a rural area desperate for any kind of improved access to be able to get with the rest of the world?
I mean, you know, it's anytime there's policy uncertainty, companies tend not to invest. During the financial crisis, you know, a lot of businesses were sort of in a holding pattern until we figured out what was going to happen with the banks, right? And that sort of that statement that was made by Stevenson from AT&T on Wednesday, that came, you know, this week. This is brand new information. And another bit of brand new information that came out was that the University of Delaware put out a poll in the last couple of months here, and 81% of the folks that they talked to were opposed to strongly opposed to paid prioritization. And that also, on the public side at least, is not a partisan issue. It's bipartisan. You know, it was roughly equivalent amounts of Republicans and Democrats that were responding to the poll, and that was 81% of the people. You can check out that poll. You can find that on the net. It's live on udel.edu. And that coverage is, that sort of thing is important, I think, because it's being super politicized right now. The president coming out was like, great. It's awesome to see that, you know, the chief executive is concerned about the well-being of the internet and addressing the 4 million comments that came through the FCC. But when that happens, it super politicized the issue. And on the ground, at least for consumers, you know, everyone has a vested interest in the net having, you know, an equal playing ground. So I think it's important to go back to the fact that this is a widely popular thing that's happening. It's not just the vested political interests. It's the people, like the folks in the rural areas that support net neutrality.
And there was, it's fair to say, quite a blowback against Ted Cruz. I think he ended up deleting that tweet after he put it up. And I guess we should at least ask the question, is there, you know, is this really the internet moving at the speed of government? Is there any validity at all? Is there anything that you can pull out of that has any validity at all that even really can be answered?
About Ted Cruz's statement?
Yeah.
in particular, which was, did we say what it was that he called Obamacare of the Internet?
Yes.
Yeah.
No. I don't really think so. That was, but you bring up, I think it brings up an important point, and it again goes back to just how politicized this issue is. And, you know, we're kind of living in a new world after last week with Republican Senate, a Republican House, and a president who's got no more elections. So I think kind of watching these things play out, for someone who watches politics, is very interesting, you know, aside from the substance, which is fundamentally important, but the politics are fascinating.
Let me ask you about this politics. Is this something that Ted Cruz, who will be in the majority as of a couple of months from now, you know, there will be committees that that he and other Republicans will be on. Is this an issue that they're going to push if they sense that there's a tremendous amount of public backlash against them on it?
Well, so far we're starting to see some rumblings of that, if you will. On the House side, the Republicans in the House have already noticed up a hearing for December to talk about what the FCC can and can't do. Mm-hmm. But, of course, the FCC can do whatever it wants. But, you know, the political fear, of course, is that the FCC goes forward, follows Obama's lead, reclassifies the Internet, and then the Republican Congress passes legislation that says you can no longer do that. And then, of course, the question becomes, well, does Obama veto that legislation? That all kind of remains to be seen. I think what we're seeing right now is the Republicans kind of dipping their toe in the water to see how popular that issue is, how much traction they can get with it. But what's interesting here is a poll was just released, I think yesterday or the day before, that actually shows that the majority of Americans support net neutrality, including conservative voters. Mm-hmm. So it seems to me like there's a split here between the conservative voters and the Republicans in Congress. So hopefully that will kind of work itself out here in the next couple of weeks, and the Republicans hopefully will back off. We'll see what happens.
We got time for one more quick call here. I want to get Jake in Rochester on the line. Hi, Jake.
Hello. Yeah, I just had one more quick comment, especially about the prioritization issues. One of the things that Netflix was complaining about is they thought Verizon was throttling their bandwidth. Many users were complaining about their streams buffering, and I think it was Time Warner or Comcast replied, it wasn't us. There was just too much traffic. It was the Internet backbone problem. Time Warner and Comcast can still make sweetheart deals with companies like Netflix by allowing them to have their servers actually at Time Warner's locations, because if Netflix has, like, their main server cluster in, say, California, if it's coming all the way across the country, they're going to have problems because there's only a limited amount of space going back and forth. They can still make deals with the various localities in order to, you know, host their servers at the site, which would greatly increase their speed without necessarily running into the net neutrality issue. I'll just listen to your comment out there. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Jake.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And by having that extra, you know, CDN or sort of server outpost there, that's exactly the type of, you know, you can't have it both ways, right? At one point, you have these companies saying, we've invested all of this money and, you know, we deserve to have these prioritization results. But then they can say, actually, we're going to sit on our hands and do inaction when the Internet backbone can't provide for these things anymore. And we're going to sit back and we're going to wait for third-party entities to come forward and invest into this infrastructure. So either you're going to be, you know, properly updating the infrastructure and keeping it alive, or you're going to depend on the third parties to do it. I mean, you can't expect special policy treatment for that. And to be able to play both sides like that is disingenuous, and it really confuses the issue of consumer access to information and data.
All right, we're down to our final couple of minutes here. Let me ask both of you, and I'll start with you, Julie. Make the case economically, if you would. What are the benefits, especially for the startups that you work with? What can they bring to the economy if they have full access to the same pipelines that everybody else does?
Yeah, so I actually think this is an incredibly important argument. Let me take a step back for a second and tell you that some research we did with the Kauffman Foundation shows that net new job growth in this country comes from new startups, not small businesses, but new high-growth startups. So new companies is where we get all of our new jobs. So we need new companies. And if you kind of give certain incumbents, it goes without saying, obviously, that almost every new company today relies on the Internet to reach customers, to get its name out there, even if it's an internet-based business or even if not. So if you have a world where new companies don't have the same opportunities online that the incumbents do, it's going to be really bad news economically for our country because we're not going to see as many new jobs. And that's pure economics.
All right. We're running up against the end of the hour. Fascinating discussion. Remy, any really quick last thoughts on what this could mean, especially for Rochester?
In the U.S., we'll see developer growth of 28% for jobs, and those developers need internet, and the average salaries are high, and if we want to take advantage of those new jobs, we can't slow down the place where those jobs happen, which is the internet.
All right, thank you so much. Julie Samuels, Executive Director of Engine, Remy DeCausemaker from RIT's Magic Center, thank you so much for being with us. We are back after the break with a discussion of subsidies for childcare coming up on Connections from member-supported public radio.